Hey, welcome to Behind the Scenes with Sonda, a podcast with a focus on tackling the challenges in the healthcare billing world. I'm your host, Sonda Kunze, and I'm here to share about the real issues in healthcare billing. On this podcast, I'll be talking about the challenges that face providers every day when dealing with these large insurance carriers, showcasing the barriers that have to be overcome just to get paid. I have over 30 years experience in all aspects of the business side of healthcare. And with my expertise, I hope to provide you with some critical information and support regarding the world of healthcare billing. Together, we can make an impact. So let's dive in. Hey, welcome to another episode of Behind the Scenes with Sonda. And today I'm going to unpack compliance. So the theme of today's podcast is Compliance 101, everybody's favorite subject, not. And why not? You know, I think that it's just one of those things that everybody says, you know, I haven't been audited yet. I probably won't be audited. I don't have a big practice. I don't do anything wrong. I just see patients, et cetera, et cetera. But honestly, it is something that is required as of the Affordable Care Act to enroll with Medicare or Medicaid. So it's not what we would call voluntary anymore if you're enrolling, okay? And if you haven't enrolled in Medicare or Medicaid, it's just a good idea to have one. I think it's important to understand how many things in your practice or your organization could be at risk if you don't have a compliance plan put in. And I think that the reason I'm doing it on a podcast, because remember, we'll have webinars or courses and things that you can really dig in, especially if you're a compliance officer and you love this stuff. There are plenty of ways for you to dig in, and we'll have in the show notes a lot of information on where you can get the OIG information and all their references. They have a ton on their website. So what we're talking about isn't anything new. It's out there. It's just that, honestly, it's just not everybody's favorite subject. Now, I happen to be the one who geeks out on compliance because I just love it. And for a shout out, I always go to the Healthcare Compliance Association, HCCA's annual Compliance Institute. It's fantastic. If you haven't ever been there, I recommend you go look on their website, especially if you like compliance, because it is several days of really great people talking, speakers and information. And I always leave with more information than I showed up with. So tonight again, or today, if you're listening to this, sometimes it's not nighttime. It's only nighttime when I record it. Anyway, OIG guidance is out there now. It started way back when in, 1999 to 2000. There is definitely a lot put out there by the OIG, but just recently in November of 2023, they kind of updated their information, sent it out, and had a ton of really good information in it. And not only that, I feel it was really published in a way that's consumable by practices. So again, I'm talking to practices tonight that either you don't have one in, or you're not sure yours has been updated in a while. And why the heck is it important? So if you're listening and you're like, cool with that, that's the subject today, compliance. And I always love to say, let's talk about the F word. And of course, we are talking about fraud and nothing else. Fraud really doesn't lend itself to intent. In other words, there are bad actors out there who intend to commit fraud. Some folks, the intent isn't there. It's a mistake. But they're unwilling to disclose because they're afraid of things that will happen, et cetera, et cetera. The conversation is a long one. But just a little bit about fraud. We're just going to talk top of the line here. This is Compliance 101 chit chat on your morning drive or your walk with a dog or whatever suits your fancy when you tune in and listen. Again, this is talking to organizations. So there's this anti-kickback statute that people think, oh, that's not me. I'm sure I don't have anything going on. But honestly, I am still surprised when I hear of a lab placing a phlebotomist inside of a physician's office for no cost to them. Now, and they say, oh, yeah, you can bill a phlebotomy, a blood draw and it'll be fine. And in that case, you've got to understand that it's too good to be true. You should not be billing for something that is not a cost to you. And not only that, of course, your labs are then going to get sent to one lab, the lab that gave you that phlebotomist. So I think we got a little bit too many things going on there for me to unpack that again on a podcast. But typically, you should ask yourself, is this too good to be true? And it probably is, because basically, you are prohibited against any kind of exchange or an offer to exchange anything of any value to induce or reward referrals. It's any type of remuneration whatsoever. So you've got to really be careful and ask yourselves some questions about what's being offered, whether it's by a vendor or anything like that, or a lab. That's just one I happen to know about that has happened in the past. And every now and then it creeps up and it's very surprising. And things like that, you want to put it to the test. And if you go into that OIG document, it will give you some questions to ask. If somebody is offering you something in order for you to make money, then definitely it's not a good thing. And why is this a problem? Because it's really surprising sometimes that people say, I mean, I get a $25 gift card when I go get my tires done or something like that. This is not healthcare dollars over here, that it's okay in many other forms of business. And that isn't what we're talking about. But when you start dealing with healthcare and federal dollars, and again, you just don't want to be dealing with that scenario. So you should definitely ask yourself some questions and make sure that any type of relationship with you have with somebody, you are not getting any remuneration for any referrals one way or the other, or somebody's not putting somebody in your office to help you bill for something that you have no expense. Somebody's not giving you a free office space. There's so many things that you can think of, but really you've got to be careful with that. It has felony punishing type of things out there. And I believe the fine's like $100,000 and up to 10 years with a conviction. And it could be mandatory exclusion from ever working with the federal government again in a healthcare scenario. So the information is packed into that compliance update from November. That's one anti-kickback. Another one is Stark Law. So Stark Law is just basically saying you as a provider or any of your family members cannot own, what I want to say, you cannot have a financial relationship. Now, there are exceptions, and talk to a lawyer. I could never name them. I would also go to a lawyer if I needed some information for that for one of my clients. But you can't refer patients for designated health services to any organization in which you, as the provider, have any type of or closest family member has any type of financial relationship with. Basically, what you want to avoid is any you making any money off of another group where, again, you just have a financial relationship from any kind of Medicare or federally funded healthcare program. So again, that's the Stark Law, and I'm just really touching the surface. This isn't about teaching you exactly what the Stark Law is. It's about just kind of talking about compliance and all. So if those of you who think your organization isn't at risk, we've got the anti-kickback, we've got the Stark Law, and then we've got the False Claims Act. And I think people don't understand about the False Claims Act is that it actually is something that doesn't have to have proof of intent. It is literally you did not follow the guidelines in order to send a claim, or your claims were sent with false information. Let me give you an example. A lot of times in the behavioral health space, we're talking about agencies who have people working in the field. And one of the toughest things with this, and again, I'm not saying this happens everywhere. I'm just telling you it has, if there's risk, it could happen to you, even if your organization is one of the, your mission is to take care of people, and you don't even think twice that you would never bill for things that didn't happen. But listen, what happens is if you have 100 providers working out in the field and you give them productivity to meet, it will inevitably be in some human being to go too far to the right in order to meet the standards. It's never a great idea to do it like that. There's plenty other ways to do things, and just giving somebody a production standard and you don't have, you know, visual sight over them. You're not in an office watching. They're out in the community serving a community. And those services go to Medicaid. Let's just give you an example. That patient is not getting an explanation of benefits like a normal person who has commercial carrier who gets an explanation of benefits. Therefore, it could be a long period of time before anyone recognizes that that patient wasn't actually seen for those services. And it could add up to thousands of dollars. And when you have to self-disclose that, it can be very painful to your organization. It's just something that happens. That's an example for you. There are other examples. Somebody who is coding the higher level based on something they put into a chart when they know that it's potential that they didn't. Like, for example, saying that you had spent 50 minutes with a patient when indeed that time period didn't actually match. Maybe it was only 40, but you're saying 50 in order to get a higher level of code. And that is actually intent there. But just giving you a couple of examples where the False Claims Act could come into play. You should never change a record if you get request. That is fraudulently changing records in order to meet the code, which is, again, punishable. And it's quite a bit in the False Claims Act. And you don't want to get in that scenario. So I think that just getting, again, chit-chatting in podcasts, it's more of there are things that could happen to you as an organization that you may not think about, but you are at risk. So you want to consider those things. So anti-kickback could come into play. Stark Law typically comes into play with a physician who owns another business or a family member owns another business where regular workers might not actually know about. False Claims Act would be just, again, erroneous claims and you knowingly or acted in what we call reckless disregard for actual truth. And think about many times Medicare comes out with their training sessions, their MedLearn matters, their all of the Medicare administrative contractors try to put out local coverage determinations. There are items that teach you what you should and shouldn't do in coding. Sometimes those things don't seem logical to a physician. So you need to unpack that, think about it, talk about it, and make sure that they're understanding why a Medicare or administrative contractor would put those into place. Nobody actively goes in and says, let me make this physician, let me make this therapist or anybody upset because we don't really want to pay them. That's not what the law comes into play. And I had posted something on LinkedIn earlier today of a case that was a public case out on the OIG website. And it just was really unbelievable what this company did. And if you want to take a look, you'll have to go out there to LinkedIn. I don't want to go too far into it, but literally a hospital was quite aware of a provider who was basically creating revenue for them, but putting patients at risk and also just doing some things with claims that were not good, right? And the whole thing unpacked. And now that hospital really is in bad light. I mean, and rightfully so. If they were truly turning a blind eye because the revenue was something that they were holding on to as a great thing, then they missed the boat. But in the meantime, patients got hurt. And it's really upsetting to see things like that happen. And my post was just to say, hey, you know, if you can't understand why there needs to be guardrails in place, rules in place, and guidelines, this is the reason why. Not everybody's a bad actor, probably a very small percentage. And we always hear in it that makes it bad for the good guys. And yeah, sometimes you're right. It does kind of make it bad for the good guys. But if you follow the guidelines, a lot of times it actually will make sense where we'll talk to providers and they go, makes sense why they would do it. It's not great, but we understand. So having a conversation about whatever service you provide and look it up. Are there any TPEs on it, targeted probes and education for Medicare? Are there any local coverage determinations? Maybe you do business with Aetna and Anthem. Those are your biggest payers. Whatever service you provide, go out and see if they have any reimbursement policies. These are things that will show you what your organization is at risk for, and that will help you design a compliance plan. And please understand, you'll go out and read the OIG guidance and it will seem overwhelming, but remember, you need to bring it down to the level that your office is. Sometimes I'll hear, well, I'm just a therapist and I have someone answering the phone. You know, and then there's things that you can do. Like you're not going to be worried about labs. You're not going to be worried about x-rays. You're probably not going to be worried about sending people in designated health service and things like that. Hopefully, not saying you won't, but I'm just saying it's not typical. Then what is at risk? Well, maybe therapy, maybe the way something's submitted. Perhaps you didn't keep up with your treatment plan. There's risks where you want to put in stop gaps, and maybe you have a partner, outside vendor looking in for you and saying, oversee and do an audit of my therapy, maybe 10 cases a year, whatever works for you and is your good faith effort with some rules, regulations, some guidelines in there, then you are doing your best at creating a compliance plan. And I don't want to make it simple as one, two, three. You're basically evaluating how much business you have, who do you do business with. What are your risks? And then how do you mitigate them? Even a partner, like there's a lot of people out there who audit our company audits as well, but I'm just saying we can take a quick look based on all the guidelines we know, based on the insurance carriers you do business with, and give you feedback on what you could be audited for. And we can detect errors and talk you through things like that. So there's those three big type of laws for fraud. And there's also things that you should know about self-disclosure. And again, I don't want to go into it on a podcast, but you can look that up. It's ways of reporting your own findings when there are larger findings that have to get reported to the federal government or to a federally funded health plan. There's also corporate integrity agreements. So this is what a organization would do in order to mitigate issues with false claims or other situations, not just false claims, but it's like in exchange for the OIG's agreement that it won't exclude them or put them on the exclusion list, they enter into an agreement. And then there's oversight with that and everything. This is a very serious thing. It's not just what's on paper, you fill out something and then it's over. A corporate integrity agreement is something that needs to be followed, and there's more people involved than just your organization. We all know about the HIPAA Privacy and Security Act. Again, too lengthy to go into, and by that time, people will be yawning about talking about that. But again, there's types of things in that. There is the exclusion list we were just talking about with the IOG or IOG, oh my goodness, OIG. The exclusion list, a best practice is for you to look at that monthly. And there are organizations that will do on your behalf, especially if you've got a lot of providers. So you want to think about that. We'll put some of those in the show notes as well. And just overall, real quick to not stretch it out too long. Remember, this is just a quick one behind the scenes with me, no guest this week, is talking about those seven elements and run through them real quick. Written policies and procedures. Again, you look in, you kind of look inside. What are we doing? What services are we providing? What risks are there? What written policies and procedures can we have when people come to work for us? They know this is how we handle something. That's a written policy and procedure. You need some compliance, leadership, and oversight. And again, if you're a really small organization, I get it. You can't have the one person who works there wear all the hats. It doesn't work. So you may want to have a relationship with somebody outside of your organization that sort of is the leader in that whole compliance thing and kind of gives the oversight. Depends on how big your organization is, because some organizations are extremely large, they have boards. They have executive committees and they could have a compliance officer. And that is a role that is defined from the OIG in that document. So again, you want to take a look at that. Training and education. Okay, near and dear to my heart. Love training and education. And please know, as an organization, training and education is never a one and done thing, right? Even myself, when I'm learning something new in healthcare law or a new code that came out, I have to hear it more than once. I have to research it more than once. Information will come out about it more than once. The code definition may change more than once. So I think the folks who just, as people become employed, do the training and education and never revisit it, are doing it themselves and their employees or their team members a great disservice, because you always want to have your education and training done at reasonably, at least once per quarter. Maybe if you're, again, a small organization, once every 6 months, whatever fits, to make sure that you're giving the most recent information about compliance to all of your team members. Effective lines of communication. There's a whole thing about this. Bigger organizations can have a hotline. Smaller organizations have to figure out a way to make sure that someone who needs to report something will never have any type of repercussions for doing so. And they need safe space and a safe way to do that. You'll have to figure that out. You got to enforce your standards. If you're going to talk about it, have it in a compliance plan and not enforce it, eventually you're going to get yourself caught up in it. Because if you have a plan and you don't follow it, it's really kind of worse than not having a plan, right? You need one, but certainly write it in a fashion that everyone can meet the standard, and the standards are enforced when somebody goes outside the line. So be prepared for that and document it, for goodness sakes. Document, document, document. You need to constantly risk assess in auditing and monitoring. And that's the part I was talking about. You possibly need an outside partner for that. You can have internal auditing and monitoring. However, it's one of those things that if you are in a small organization, there will be favorites and they'll say, well, that doctor doesn't mean to write it like that, or that doctor doesn't mean to do that. I know what he meant. And that can get you into trouble too. So having an outside partner to help with your risk assessment, or if you're a large enough group, make sure it's somebody who doesn't have to answer to that provider on a day-to-day basis. That would make them uncomfortable giving feedback if something is wrong and they find it. And you must respond to these detected offenses. So make sure you have a corrective action plan. Those are the quick 7 elements that you got to think about. Then again, I just want to reiterate as we sort of wrap this up, I can't tell you how much I just love talking about it, but that's the truth. That's how I am about it. But you need to read this new publication that came out, or somebody in your organization who understands coding, billing, documentation, and some part of compliance, to kind of break it out, chunk it out, right? How to eat an elephant, one bite at a time, same thing. Don't get overwhelmed by it, but have it, read it, and try to understand pieces and parts. The biggest thing in it that you can have a response to is taking those 7 elements and figuring out where to get started. And if you don't, reach out to somebody who works with this all the time. They can work with you to write a very small plan. You can always make it bigger, better, improve on it, but at least it's something that goes into play. Find your risk areas, decide what they are, and then decide how you're going to use those 7 elements to combat that. I mean, some groups don't bill very much, and that's okay. These smaller therapist groups, even that, sometimes you could have an issue pop up that if it's been years of going on and Medicare comes back and says you shouldn't have been doing it for years, it can add up to a lot of money, even if you don't submit a lot of claims for that. So again, understanding that a lot of the times people say to me, I've never been audited, it's never been a problem for me. I think you need to know that typically the insurance carriers, sometimes they're on it, but most of the time they're going back. They find a pattern. They see how long it's been going on, and then it starts adding up. Then they start looking at your records from a year ago, 2 years ago, and you might even have made changes. And so you have an opportunity to show them that you put something into play, you're following it, and it definitely makes you look like you're doing best practice. So it's never too late to get a compliance plan in. And that is the moral of the story. Again, this has only been compliance 101 chit-chat during a podcast. It's up to you to research the information. And we're hoping to get out a little mini course and have documents in there that people can use in action and put them into play in their own organization. So look for that upcoming. And we hope to see you soon. And thank you again for joining in for Behind the Scenes with Sanda. It's yet the end of another podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Scenes with Sanda. Remember, you can make a difference by sharing this podcast with others who are experiencing the same struggles. The more we reach, the more chances we have to create a community of like-minded people who want to impart change to the business side of healthcare. If you love this episode, please don't forget to rate and review. Until next time, stay curious, stay inspired, and keep learning.